welcome to the Media Matters podcast, presented by myself, Colette Sexton, news correspondent at the Sunday Business Post. In each episode, we talk to an expert in the media and marketing industry and pick their brain on the topics that matter. Today's guest is Jane Suter. Jane is director of the Institute for Future Media and Journalism and associate professor in the School of Communications at Dublin City University. Jane is a former journalist, having worked as economics editor at the Irish Times and for various other media outlets. Thanks for joining me, Jane.
No problem.
Jane, do you want to fill me in a bit on your background and how you ended up going from the Irish Times into this position in DCU?
Yeah, sure. So I'd worked in journalism in London and in Dublin for a few years, ending up as economics editor at the Irish Times.
Very prestigious.
Yes. And actually really good fun and really interesting. You get to meet a lot of great people and have a lot of really good colleagues. But the Irish Times at that time then started doing, a round of redundancies and so on. And I just thought it through and I decided that I would take one and see what else I could do. So I went off to Trinity and did a PhD while freelancing. And then eventually sort of wound my way around the various Irish universities, ending up in DCU in the School of Communications.
Landing nicely in DCU.
Yeah, so that way I was able to kind of combine my previous media experience as well as my PhD together. So now I have a really nice role. I'm really lucky where I get to do lots of interesting things, but still kind of have a toe in the water of media, which is, you know, an environment I've always loved.
And what was your PhD in?
I did it in political economy. We actually did, I worked with Primetime. We did a Primetime special on it, but it was on government ministers and how they managed to get a flow of money to their own constituencies, particularly in kind of sports and education and roads and that kind of thing. So it was actually nothing to do with media whatsoever.
Sounds fascinating.
It was
though,
much more yeah. political economy, including the kind of politics of it and things.
Quite a newsworthy PhD.
A newsworthy one, yeah. That's how we got a prime time out of it, yeah.
In your position now, you can see the next generation of journalists coming through, and more so than the rest of us know who they are and what they're about. What are they in general terms? Who are they and why are they getting into journalism now?
Well, I suppose there's, in DCU, there's two different lots. So we have the undergrads, and they come through the normal kind of CAO process. So they're largely, there's maybe 10% are from outside of Ireland, but they're largely Irish. And they're largely just inquisitive people who want to know more about the world, want to ask questions, and so on. And of course, some of them are keen on being on the telly or on radio and that kind of thing. So there's a variety of people, as there always has been. And then in terms of the MAs, they come from all over the place. So some come from law or sciences, a lot of arts, social sciences, and a large number of those come from all around the world. So typically the MA in journalism would have people from five or six different countries in it, which is really good because there's kind of a very diverse perspective. But there's actually a strong demand for, like, a lot of the people want to be journalists, but also the kind of skills that you learn in a journalism degree are very transferable. So if you don't want to be a journalist, there's plenty of other things you can do afterwards with the kind of skills that you've picked up. As you'd know yourself, a lot of people in here will all be multi-skilled and be able to multitask.
Yes, yeah. Very, very multi-skilled, yeah. Or so we hope. And are they getting into journalism afterwards, Jane, or are they falling into this hole of the unpaid internships? And what are your opinions on them?
Well, we have an intro programme, and so that's actually part of both degrees. So for that, they do a period of sort of 6 weeks, and that is, some people pay, others just pay expenses, but it is part of the degree. So I think it's probably fair enough that a lot of those positions are unpaid, and the students certainly like them. They lead to great networking and contacts, and people get jobs out of that. But certainly they're still getting jobs. So it's amazing the amount of people who are now hiring, but there's a wider range. So, you know, 10 years ago, everybody wanted to be in the Sunday Business Post or the Irish Times or the Independent or whatever. But now people are getting great jobs in Storyful as well, or mm-hmm. Data Miner, or, you know, so there's all sorts of other places are going to more startups, or, you know, people are getting jobs in Facebook or Google, or, you know, so the kind of the number of jobs maybe in traditional newspapers has declined, but the overall number of jobs probably isn't all that different to what it ever was.
To any trainee journalists out there, I'd just like to say the Business Post is a fantastic place to work. You might get the free lunches like you do in the tech companies, but it's still great.
And you'll have intro places this year, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's very exciting. Really, it's good to get new talent in. I wrote a bit last year about, and this has been something that's been going on since journalism and PR existed, that a lot of journalists were going into PR. But last year in particular, there were journalists going into PR that were very prominent and well known, and it was kind of a shock to a lot of people in the industry. Yeah. And at the time when I wrote those pieces, a lot of very well-known journalists got back to me either publicly on Twitter or messaged me saying, you know, I find it very hard to recommend journalism as a career these days because, you know, the industry is just so in flux and funding is such an issue and, you know, salaries aren't as good as they used to be. What would you say to people who say that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, it is true, but then I think it is true. I think that salaries certainly aren't what they once were, and I think people probably have to be more multi-skilled and work harder than they did used to have to do, certainly in some places. But there's always been journalists who've gone into PR. There's always been journalists who've become even doctors. We've even produced comedians out of the DCU School of
Oliver Callan.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. And novelists and science communicators and all sorts of people. So, you know, it's never been that, you know, journalists tend to be people who can turn their hand to a lot of different things. So there's always been a kind of a thing where there's movement through. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but obviously the business model is under threat, and that is difficult. And but I think the best and those who are really committed to it, that there still are careers there.
So when they do leave DCU, are they going straight into kind of full-time positions, or are they going into freelance positions and then working their way up? Do some people prefer to work in a freelance basis and kind of make their own mark in that way, or are they looking for the salaried traditional positions?
Well, I suppose it's different for everybody, as it always has been. And, you know, I think that's true of kind of the whole generation now. There's much more kind of portfolio careers, there's much more freelance.
It's a gig economy, as
the gig
hearing.
Economy, you know, and, you know, journalists are certainly not immune to that. So some people do like the full-time career. And obviously the likes of RTE, you know, are still kind of providing that for people, and others, you know, we certainly have recent graduates who are in all of the news organisations and often full time. Others are freelance. So I think it depends on the person, on how much they want to specialise, how general they are, how well they kind of, some journalists fit in better into a full time office environment than others who prefer to be out and doing different things. So, you know, I think it's quite a personal decision, but it's certainly not the case that there's no full-time jobs anymore.
I think the intra program is a great idea, and it's a great way to give someone a foot in the door of a national organization. Like, it's why I myself did a master's in journalism in NUIG, not DCU, sorry, Jane, because I had no contacts in journalism, and it was a way of getting in the door. But I was also fortunate in that I was able to afford to do that. And I've spoken to newspaper editors over the last few years who say they're worried about how similar journalists are coming out of colleges these days and how they all tend to be middle class and white. And I think it's interesting that you were saying that a lot of people in the MA program in DCU are actually coming from other countries. Do you think that's helping to kind of change that a bit?
So that changes that a bit. And, you know, we obviously, as part of, you know, DCU is a university of sanctuary and so on. So and we have had undergraduates who aren't white and middle class and Irish who've gone on to full time jobs in broadcasters and so on here. And people from various backgrounds who, you know, have made the news themselves sometimes from the, you know, their kind of backgrounds without wanting to go into individual stories. So I think it's something we'd like to do even more. But it's something that we're aware of, and there are other routes in. So there's rather than just through the CAO. There's the access program and so on. There's also routes in for mature students. So again, you don't have to have achieved the CAO points for that. So there are different routes in, and you know, I think there's probably a greater amount of diversity than there perhaps was a good few years ago. But again, like, Irish society is more diverse. So I suppose all we can do is just try harder for diversity.
And try to reflect that a bit more.
Yeah.
Speaking of diversity, we're at a stage now where we don't have a national newspaper in Ireland that's edited by a woman, which is actually a step backwards compared to what we used to have years ago. We had the likes of Anne Harris and Geraldine Kennedy editing national newspapers. Do you think that there is a problem with women climbing their way up the ladder in journalism? Is there something blocking them from getting to the top?
Yeah, so there certainly is. You know, the European Commission has done quite a lot of reports into this right across Europe, and indeed across a lot of the OECD countries. And it's a bit like in academia as well. What you find is that the top positions are quite often male, and the more junior positions are female. Of course, when it's easy to say, well, women are more likely to leave in their mid-30s after a few children than men are. I think that's certainly true, but there's certainly plenty of women who don't leave and who also don't find their way to the top. So I think it's something that kind of owners and shareholders, and certainly in the case of RTE, you know, they need to be aware of. And in fact, I think RTE has done quite a lot about it, but as you say, not in a national newspaper. But it's a very competitive environment, and you know, you certainly couldn't have a quota and say that, you know, a woman has to be an editor, like she's going to have to be the right person for the job. But I'm quite sure that somewhere out there on some of the news stores, there's the right young woman waiting.
And do you think that there is something that newspapers can do that isn't necessarily quotas, but there's a way to help women become, to get into those leadership positions a bit more than what they are at the moment?
Well, there's always ways to do it. So there's ways to encourage people. There's probably a certain, one of the things in media, it's so demanding, and it can be very demanding on time, and depending on what role you're in, it can be very demanding in terms of not knowing what your hours are. Mm. You know, there's women who are inclined to move off to, say, a news desk role away from maybe a high profile correspondence role in order to get more control over their time, so as they can tell a childminder when they might be home. Whereas, you know, some positions in journalism, you just can't do that. And so that makes it really difficult. So I think to be aware of that. On the other hand, some of it is inherent in the roles as well. But it's probably something that needs to be spoken about. And once it's explicit and people are aware of it, then there's ways to deal with it. Like Geraldine Kennedy, who I worked with in the Irish Times, would have worked incredibly hard and, you know, come back from work very early and would have put in an awful lot of long hours, you know.
And DCU did a fascinating study, I think in 2015, with the BAI and the National Women's Council, just in terms of the amount of women's voices that are heard on current affairs radio programmes. And I found that female voices got an average of only 28% of broadcasting time on current affairs shows. There has been different initiatives over the years, like Women on Air for one, to get more women on air. Do you think that has improved since 2015? Is that something that you guys would look at doing again to kind of track and see how well it has improved or disimproved?
We'd certainly like to do it again. The BAI funded it last time, and I think it'd be interesting to see. Like, one of the recommendations we had back then was that the broadcasters should actually report the amount of women's voices, because unlike the idea of internal promotions, who you're actually getting on as a guest is entirely within your own remit and the decision of the producer and the presenter and the rest of the team. And I think it's been demonstrated that if you try hard, there's plenty of women out there who have as much expertise, or if not more expertise, than some of the men who are often called up as experts and on the panels and so on. But it hasn't actually gone so far as there was talk that the BAI might actually require the broadcasters to report the percentage of women voices in their annual report. And if something like that were to happen, I think then is when we would see change. So given that that hasn't happened, it probably is time to redo the exercise and to see. And in fact, there's actually technology available now. There's an academic in Trinity who has it, which can actually track voices. So
it wouldn't be a massive undertaking.
It wouldn't be a massive undertaking, and the stations wouldn't have to do anything. They could simply deploy this software, and at the end of a program, it would tell them what percentage male and female voices were actually heard on the air in that individual program. So, that technology is available through the ADAPT Centre in Trinity.
So it is something that perhaps the BAI will look at in the future, hopefully. DCU, obviously you work for the Future of Journalism unit. What should we be worried about the future of news?
Well, absolutely. So there's a paradox about it. So on the one hand, there's never been greater consumption of news, especially international news. So in Ireland, the number of people looking at the likes of the New York Times or the Washington Post, the sort of the Trump bump, if you like. So on the one hand, there's a bump to kind of quality news from Trump, but on the other hand, there's a complete undermining of news values and of people's understanding of what is news, and the difference between correct information and disinformation, and the whole thing has been weaponized. So I think that's, it's a very difficult and tricky problem, and it's one that a lot of people from the OECD to the UN to the EU Commission are all trying to look at, is this kind of idea of how do we give people the skills to understand and to ask the right questions to know what it is that they're looking at and whether somebody is trying to play them or game them.
Is it something that we should be teaching kids in schools, like how to identify a news source that is trustworthy? I think there's a lot of misinformation out there about news, and this fake news phenomenon that everyone is talking about these days is adding to that. Like, for example, I was on Facebook a couple of weeks ago, and the Irish Times had a story up about a woman who had been murdered, and she was named in the piece, but the person who had murdered her wasn't named because he hadn't been charged yet. And in the comments, everyone was giving out that the Irish Times had named the woman, the victim, but not the person who had killed her. But obviously they were unable to do so because of media law and the fact that it could end up his trial would be thrown out. But clearly that piece of education wasn't there, so people just blamed the Irish Times instead of knowing why that was reported in that way. Is that something that we should be looking at introducing to kids in primary or secondary school to teach them what they can and can't trust?
Yeah, I think so. So not just the intricacies of law, but I think the crucial thing is what kind of questions. So when you see a piece of information, what kind of questions can you ask about it to sort of ascertain whether it's something that you should trust or not? I agree that we should, it would be good to have more of this and better developed syllabi. The BAI at the moment, for example, is working on a kind of a news literacy initiative that we're part of, and that's going to be really valuable. But it's also the case that, for example, in America, it's the over 65s who shared the most fake news and disinformation. It's the over 55s who were played the most by false information that was propagated from Russia on Facebook. So
you're telling me that millennials are savvy, Jane?
Yeah, absolutely. And, so sometimes they might just press like or share because they think it's funny. Like a lot of the people who actually reshared, for example, the Pizzagate story, where Hillary Clinton was meant to be running a child sex ring under a pizza restaurant, would have actually been Democrats sharing and sort of saying, look at these Republicans, can you believe they believe this? So there's different reasons for people kind of sharing. But when you do the research, it's often older generations who didn't grow up with the web, certainly didn't grow up with social media, who are actually the most susceptible to sharing false information. And if you look at Trump's base, there's a lot of them in there.
And what can the media do about that? Is there anything that the media can do, or does that need to be something that happens at a government level?
It doesn't necessarily have to be a government level. Like, there's a lot of different initiatives. If you look at First Draft or Crosscheck, or there's a lot of the OECD has a fantastic initiative that's ongoing about different ways to check disinformation. We're part of a number of different groups, but different people have games, for example. So there's one game which seems to do really well, where you're actually told that you have to create disinformation, and you're given a range of choices about so how would you make people believe this, and you have to do it. So by the act of actually actively trying to produce disinformation, you suddenly realize how easy it is. There's other games where people go in and they have to kind of guess which one is the disinformation and why, and so it gets people into the idea of kind of thinking the right way, because a lot of the time people just rely on very simple kind of heuristics or shortcuts, you know. So do I see two sides of the argument? So often, say for example, a climate change site that wants to produce disinformation, there's one that we found last year. So it looked like a legitimate American institute that was studying climate change, but it was just totally made up. There was news stories which looked like they should be real news stories, and they'd quote a professor or somebody or other from some made up place and another from an institute. So the kind of, for somebody just kind of looking for those simple kind of things, oh, are there both sides of the story being given here? Does this person look like an expert, and so on? Those kind of things can be covered. So the kind of the actors who want to sow disinformation can be quite sophisticated. So you need to be able to get around and get people to actually think, well, does that actually make sense? You know, if I Google that, do I actually find them somewhere else? What am I going to do? So what questions am I going to ask to try to protect myself? And then there's other things that you can do. Like, we're working on one. We have a research project called Provenance, and where we're actually coming up with a verifiability indicator, which will tell you where information first originated from and the extent to which it's been tampered with on video or audio, this kind of idea of the deep fake. So then people can tap into it and see what it is that they choose to believe. So it's complex, and the bad actors will get more sophisticated, they move ahead of you. So there's a lot that needs to be tackled from kind of multiple angles.
But there are things happening, so we shouldn't be too despondent.
There's lots of people trying to work at this from lots of different angles, but they have to, just like anything else, they have to keep ahead of the actors whose interest it is to sow the disinformation.
What do you think is the biggest problem in the Irish media at the moment?
Well, I suppose there's lots of different people would tell you there's a range of problems. Like, probably is the biggest problem that actually the business model is broken, and nobody's, like, the Irish Times made some money last year on the back of the subscriptions and so on, but on the other hand, it's nowhere near back to where it was. So the whole problem with digital advertising, and, you know, Facebook and Google knowing so much about people and therefore hoovering up so much of that advertising, while at the same time that's where people are consuming their news, that's huge. It would be really interesting, actually. I listen to the podcast, so I don't think you've had Mark Little or Anya Curran.
No,
yet,
I haven't,
have
actually,
you?
No.
Yeah, so I think if you had them in, it could be really interesting, because they've got a great new startup called Kinzen.
They are on my list, yeah. I've interviewed them for the Sunday Business Post, but haven't had them on the podcast.
On this,
yet.
Yeah. So they've done an awful lot of kind of hard work and thinking about, like, where the big problem is, and trying to marry together the kind of thing about values and trust that we were talking about, and also the revenue model, which I suppose has to be the biggest problem, and trying to come up with an innovative solution. So, you know, I think that's really smart, the kind of stuff that's going on there. And then I suppose in terms of broadcasting, it's just the fact that younger people just aren't watching linear TV to the same extent. And how is RTE and its completely outdated player ever going to compete with that?
And the Broadcasting Act, which doesn't really give RTE even a remit for digital output, which also needs to be looked at. But I think that RTE is its own case in itself, in that, you know, the successive ministers for communications have just not wanted to touch it, because there is so much to be done there, and yeah, it's not very good politically to help out RTE. So, I mean, it's just been kind of left to try and solve its own problems, which I don't think it can do. Do you think that print newspapers are going to survive?
I think there'll always be, I think there'll always be a market for some form of print newspaper. I wonder whether it'll necessarily be the kind of newspaper we're used to seeing, whether it's kind of tabloid or broadsheet on newsprint with, you know, a very high print circulation. You know, I think that might be lower, and there might be more of the different ways to deliver it digitally. So rather than just having sort of PDFs of the pages and then people can read them or the different bits, I think it'll change. So there's going to be an awful lot more enhanced coverage, so you can automatically go into backgrounders or summaries. I think it'll be personalized more, so people will know, the newspaper will know better who the person is who's trying to read, and be able to deliver them kind of personalized level of coverage at the stage they're at different types of reading. Like, so for example, if I were to go in and start reading about I think there was a footballer who died this morning, if I was to go into that story and then start worrying about the football thing, I'd need a very basic kind of primer, because that's not an area that I cover in any great depth. But on the other hand, if it was about Brexit, I've been following that kind of moment by moment, and, you know, I'll want something different. But somebody else who hasn't been...
Theresa May might want kind of an explainer on Brexit, for example. Boris Johnson, certainly.
But it'll be that kind of thing. So if you actually know, if I come into the Sunday Business Post and you know who I am and kind of how far advanced I am with different stories, even if I choose that or I've got little things, you'd be able to deliver me a better experience. So the journalists won't have to, the way that we even write stories will be different. So it won't be always the most up-to-date. There will be more background ones that the AIs will be able to put in and things. So I think when that happens, it'll move news away from being the kind of free commodity where, you know, people think they can just scroll through Facebook and by looking at the headlines have seen the news.
And it's not worth their money to
It's not worth their money to do something different. So I think once they get the kind of more personalised delivery, once this kind of thing becomes more routine, then I think the amount that people are willing to pay will increase. But Irish people are even quite willing to pay, according to our research, so...
Which is a good sign. But I always say this, and I include myself in it, I think that Irish people are inherently nosy and we like to know what's going on in the world, and we tend to be quite educated in the affairs of not only what's happening nationally but also internationally, which, you know, it can be great for the news industry here if we just capitalize on that. Are students in DCU, do they read newspapers?
They don't read print newspapers.
Do they subscribe online or do they just get their information from free sites?
So it's a mixture. So if you were to go in, we must bring you in to give a class sometime soon. We'll put your arm behind your back and drag you in.
How many
subscribe to the Sunday Business Post? And it will be a minority. I suppose students are poor as well, and you know.
Yeah, I was a broke student. I just used to read the free newspapers in the room when we were in NUIG because I couldn't afford to buy them. So you can understand that.
So, but some of them will, and some of them are quite savvy about knowing which ones you can get to through social as opposed to going to the actual site, and you know, this kind of thing. So
hopefully we have blocked that enough now so that they can't, you know, incognito mode.
I think you have a hard wall, Colette.
We do. We don't let anyone in. It's great.
A hard eye wall.
Quality journalism is worth paying for, people. So overall, are you positive about the future of the industry here, or do you think that Irish news media need to kind of, do they have their heads in the sand a bit about the future and they need to pull together to work out what's going to happen next?
Yeah, well, I am positive about the future. I think it will be good, but I think that there will be innovation, and I know it's very difficult because if you're, you know, working really hard at the day job and you're trying to do what you're trying to do, the idea of somebody coming in with some new piece of software or something else for you to deal with or even think about, even if they're saying this is going to make your life easier, it's kind of the last thing you want. But on the other hand, it's probably something that's going to have to happen. we were talking to the Thompson Foundation, which does a lot of training of journalists all around the world, but especially in the old Soviet republics and North Africa and so on the other day. And they were saying this is the problem. There's so many different things that you can now bring in. But people just kind of go, you know, don't wreck my head. I've got enough to do without thinking about new things. So hopefully the owners and the shareholders will see the value in actually investing in this kind of thing, but also in more people. So, you know, people aren't overwhelmed by having to learn more stuff because, you know, it is going to have to adapt.
And people need to future-proof their careers as well. I mean, the careers of a student coming out of DCU now is probably quite different to anyone who came out 10 years ago and certainly 20 years ago. And, you know, for them to need to work for the next 40 years or however long they're going to make us work until we get our pensions these days, they're going to have to be very adaptable.
Yeah. But for example, like 5 years ago, people would have said, you know, if you had the skills of somebody in Storyful, you know, where you could really do all the high-end verification and know how to use Google Maps and translate and put everything in and check all of that. Now, Deutsche Welle in Germany has developed a tool with the European Commission.
Replacing the journalist.
To be able to do all of that kind of thing. So, you know, it's a matter of, it's the actual real journalism. So it's the actual going out, getting to stories, talking to people, having sources, you know, that's
picking up the phone.
Picking up the phone, wearing out the shoe leather, you know, that's a bit that kind of won't be replaced beyond kind of learning specific.
And robots can't do that.
Exactly.
For now, anyway.
Yeah.
What do you think the media landscape will look like here in 10 years' time?
That is almost impossible.
Well, you're all about the future, Jane. I thought you'd have all the answers for me.
Well, I'm sure that we'll still have we'll still have some broadcasters. I think we'll probably be increasingly online and on demand. And I think that the personalization will have come in. So when you go to a news website, it'll know who you are and it'll adapt to your interests. So the challenge there will be to make sure that you're not just giving people what they've ticked before. Oh, I just like current affairs and rugby and nothing else. That, you know, there's still, because a lot of what people actually value when you watch them consuming news is a lot of the serendipity. So, you know, if I just read headlines online that interest me, I'll tend to consume quite a narrow range of subjects. Whereas if I actually pick up a newspaper and read it, there's going to be lots of different little bits that I see that I wouldn't have
otherwise
kind
picked
out online. And that's true for a lot of people. So, you know, the challenge is going to be getting that right. But I think it'll be a more personalized experience. Hopefully it'll be a more holistic one. I think there'll be a lot more, obviously, digital consumption. And I'm sure there'll still be, you know, quality long reads and investigations that people will want.
That's all for this installment of the Media Matters podcast. Thanks so much to Jane Souter for popping into studio, and thanks to you all for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, please share Media Matters on your social media networks, rate us on iTunes and subscribe. If you have feedback or any suggestions for future interviewees, tweet me on Colette_Sexton. Until next time.